Like, I wonder if in some ways, by watching all of these characters go through so much change and learn so much, I wonder how much subconscious pressure I put on myself to like grow and change all the time and to be learning, when maybe in fact I could just be happy the way I am at the moment and not strive to improve myself in any way or to learn something new.
When we see conflicts play out in an hour, does that give us the pressure of needing to resolve conflicts in our life within an hour? And also, does it lead us to ever dramatize our life where it's like, I'm narrating my life and wow, I'm a movie character and this is so dramatic and awful and I need to go fight with this person and resolve this person. Like, wait, I like how this is like a tool book for both professional storytellers and also like someone who just, you know, someone like me.
I think just someone who loves stories.
Welcome to Bamboo and Glass, a space where we share the underrepresented perspectives that shape our lifelong journey of learning and unlearning. I'm Sophia.
And I'm Tan. As a quick reminder, we release new episodes every Sunday, and you can listen wherever you listen to podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and TikTok at Bamboo and Glass to see memorable quotes from our guests and from us, and also see updates about new episodes. You definitely want to check out our TikTok because we actually did a couple of TikToks talking about the book that we are talking about today, Craft in the Real World: Rethinking Fiction Writing and Workshopping by Matthew Salises. And it's a book that challenges current models of craft and the writing workshop by showing how they fail marginalized writers and how cultural expectations inform storytelling. So I wanted to talk about this book with you, Sophia, because obviously I have been thinking a lot about storytelling. And I think on podcasts, we do a certain type of storytelling. And I think what maybe we don't get to see is how a lot of people are educated and trained in the storytelling world, especially when it comes to creating pieces of work like books and movies that are things that people will continue to rewatch over and over again. And so I think it's really fascinating to just see what that craft is like. I think that there are some aspects of representation that we haven't gotten to talk about very much in the popular media, but this book really addresses.
Yes, I'm so excited for this episode because from what I know, the author is a writing professor, and I was really interested in his perspective because I think when we talk about you know, movies that get awards and get nominations, I think we talk about it from a very like everyday consumer perspective, but it'll be really interesting to hear like from the perspective of someone who teaches storytelling and writing, how do they teach, like what are things that people are taught and things that people are not taught, and what are perspectives and styles of storytelling that I don't even realize are undervalued. So I'm super excited for this. Also, thank you for making those fun TikToks. So many people have discovered them and like asked a lot of questions. It has been so surprising.
Yeah, I really did not think people would care that much, honestly. Like, this is a book that Karen from the Cosmos introduced me to, and I just thought it had so many nuggets, and so I was just kind of eager to just document it, and it just got so much of a reception. People really responded to that TikTok about showing and not telling, and so I think that just fires me up for this episode because we're gonna talk about even more things.
I'm fired up too.
So I want to start off by learning more about each of our backgrounds when it comes to what we've colloquially or in school have learned about storytelling. So what have you been taught in like English class, writing class, when it comes to how to make stories and the structure of stories? And what are some themes that you've kind of noticed in your free time too from consuming?
Okay. One very common technique that I learned since elementary school is every story needs to have a beginning, a middle, and end. And there needs to be a conflict. It's either the character has a conflict with himself, with someone else, with nature, etc. And the main character needs to undergo change for the story to be meaningful or interesting. So that's what I learned from school since a very young age. And then I started watching a lot of TV and dramas in high school and college. And I particularly enjoyed K-dramas and also Jane the Virgin, which is a telenovela. And there was something that these two genres have in common is they have these like tropes that are really so that are used very often, where it's like, oh, a very sudden cancer diagnosis or a secret twin. And what I love is that even though these tropes are really well known, I actually still enjoy it when stories include them. And it's still really fun to see how these tropes play out. I don't find it mm-hmm. overused or annoying at all. And then recently, we both watched This Is Us, a beautiful, beautiful TV show.
Very sad that it's over.
I know. Well, I'm rewatching my favorite episode, so it's not over yet.
So it's not quite over yet.
Yes. What I love about the narrative structure is that at a high level, there are two timelines that you're jumping between. So there's like the two parents and their three kids. And so you're jumping between the timeline of when the parents are in their 30s and when the kids are in their 30s. And I thought this structure was really interesting because every episode has a theme and you see this theme play out in different moments of their lives. And you see it all come together in a very cool way. So those are some of my experiences with storytelling and some things that I've liked in the stories I've consumed recently.
I think it's interesting that K-drama and telenovela are shows that aren't traditionally shown in Hollywood, and you really like a lot of those tropes, even if they're overused. That's really great. I think the beginning, middle, and end structure is something that still is true, and it's funny that we learned that from such a young age, because even professionals, they're always operating off of the three act structure. There is the world building aspect where you set the tone of what this story is going to be about, and then there's always an inciting incident in act one where it kind of sets off the problem or the conflict. And then at the end of act one, it involves usually a hero or a protagonist gaining the resolve to make a change or to go do something about it. And then act two is like, you know, all of those tribulations, trials and errors that happen. I find that there's also usually a scene where if they have a companion with them, they have a heart-to-heart. I just feel like that always happens, where like they're about to go to sleep or there's some downtime because they just got away from the monster and they're opening up to each other about their deepest secrets or desires and wants. And then I feel like there's usually like a betrayal that happens or some really big low right before the climax kind of takes off, and you know that for the most part, most of these people are going to survive. They're going to have their happy ending. And I think with franchises too lately, there's usually like a cliffhanger that ends the whole story because they want you to stay tuned for the rest, for the next movie that comes out. And so no matter what form it takes, clearly there's still like a thirst for it. And it's interesting though, because it's something that can still be seen as overused. And it kind of made me wonder like, oh, I wonder what gaps or questions we have around storytelling. Have you ever watched something that you kind of was like, oh, this was like really refreshing and it doesn't do things the same way as a lot of these other stories that I've seen?
In watching music videos, which are really short, usually just 4 minutes. And watching music videos, especially the ones that are kind of just like vibes, they hint at a story, but also there's no real story. It's kind of just like vibes and vignettes. That got me kind of curious about like, oh, what if there was a whole movie that was just kind of vibes and vignettes? And also growing up, I learned a lot of stories of like Chinese creation mythology. I didn't read the actual original text. I just read like the kids' version of it in like a Chinese textbook. But I've always been really curious like how Chinese storytelling from hundreds and thousands of years ago differs from the storytelling we see today.
Yeah. I also have done like my own research on like Korean folk tales, because that was always something I was really interested in. And something that I realized is that none of these stories for the most part have morals in them. Like there's not really a happy ending or a takeaway from them. And I thought that was just so fascinating that those are stories that are continually passed down over generations. And we actually, like, on the big screen for the most part, we don't actually see a lot of those stories. In fact, if we see adaptations of it, for example, like Over the Moon kind of adapts a Chinese folktale about a Chinese goddess, kind of morphs it so that it does fit that three-act structure where there is a conflict that this mythical creature or goddess goes through, and it's something that they are able to have some closure about. And it's interesting because you see how big the gap is between the original story and then it becoming commercialized into a big, like, 6-7-figure feature film.
Yeah. You know, another style of storytelling I just remembered is thinking about reading the Bible when I was growing up, and reading analyses of biblical texts in different books of the Bible, because there are books that are written in different time periods by different people from different cultures. And what I remember is that there are some books of the Bible that are written more like a poem that would be passed down orally. And so there are some facts or numbers that are not necessarily like factual in the way that we consider them to be factual, but more like mnemonic devices or tools and like storytelling tools to help you remember the structure of the story and what happens. So,
the Bible is also known as a source that has a lot of contradictions in it. And I think in media nowadays with books and movies, you're not supposed to have contradictions. Like everything is supposed to make sense to an extent, which is why I think maybe the movie recently, Everything Everywhere All at Once, might have been refreshing for some folks, because there are a lot of things about that film that don't make sense and maybe contradict one another. But you kind of just go along with the flow of it. So because you are able to not, you're not able to predict anything that happens in that film. And so that kind of entices people and trigger and intrigues them even more to want to learn what happens next and what's going to, what's the end going to be like? Because based on the structure, it hasn't been linear in any way.
Yeah, that's a great example of a story with a really unique structure that felt a lot more like, the takeaway was the chaotic vibes and less of like the specific details of the plot and like what happens first and what flashback happens later.
And I think this kind of goes into our next thing around non-Western media, because I think as we've been growing up, we have been consuming more of that. It's been more popular and more accessible, with Netflix having more access to foreign cinema, Asian films especially, like getting a lot of recognition and award ceremonies and stuff. And so for me, I started noticing especially a gap when I started watching Miyazaki films. So this is a director who I actually never really grew up watching him. And for the most part, every time I tried to watch, I found it really boring. Like I had a really hard time getting staying engaged, because there's so much space, there is not much talking sometimes, and it's just kind of like, why am I staring at this patch of grass for a minute? But I think with like the pandemic and things slowing down a little bit and me kind of getting tired of the predictability of a lot of these films, I actually found Miyazaki to be really refreshing, and I got to see it from a new lens where it does feel more slice of life. There are things that happen at the beginning where normally I would expect it to make an appearance again at the end, and that doesn't necessarily happen with Miyazaki films. And so I kind of appreciated how things were sometimes just coincidental and just there, because that's just part of life for it to be there. And that was something that's a big difference that I've noticed. That is interesting, because I've heard so many like animators mentioned Miyazaki as a huge inspiration, but there's has yet to be a film that emulates the style or the structure of a Miyazaki film. I guess along the Japanese train, I've been watching a lot of anime as well lately, partly because James has gotten really into it. And this kind of goes back to the TikTok I made about show, don't tell. That's probably a lesson you heard when you were in school. We also talk about that when we write our personal statements, which we talked about in a previous episode. And in anime, they actually do a lot more telling and not showing. So they will literally share the whole character's internal monologue. Like it'll slow down, you know, epic action scenes, they'll slow it down where like they're slowly nearing the enemy. And while that's happening, he's kind of narrating like, oh shoot, like I'm not prepared for this. Like, what is going to happen? Like, someone else should have been more qualified to this. But, oh, well, like, it has to be me, because we just have to bring our resolve in order to defeat this villain. It kind of has that type of internal monologue that I feel like normally in Western media, they would want to show visually through, like, a close-up of, like, a hand, like, tremoring or something like that. And so it's just really interesting to see how engaging anime still is and how entertaining it still is for me without it feeling like too much telling, actually.
Yeah, that's so true. I love that aspect of anime, and I never even thought of it as a contradiction of the rule, because I really love it. I think it's super effective.
Yeah. Have you noticed anything with non-Western media? I know you have been a big K-drama fan. I'm curious, like, what have you noticed about K-dramas?
Yes, I've watched maybe 4 or 5 K-dramas. My favorite part is that they take quite a bit of time developing the characters and their relationships and their daily life and the vibe of their life. The slow buildup to those romantic gestures is so satisfying and beautiful, and you just like really fall in love with the characters. Another thing, I don't know if this is a K-drama thing, but I noticed this discussion a lot for this K-drama called Startup, which is about the tech founders. There's the main lead called Namdo-san. He's kind of this like clueless startup founder. He doesn't grow too much throughout the story, even though he is given a lot of chances to change and grow. But he doesn't really change that much. And a lot of people criticized him for being this annoying flat character, but then a lot of other people were on the other side and said, you know, he's really relatable, he's really flawed, and he doesn't need to go through a ton of change in order to be like a really beloved, well-loved, meaningful character that makes people feel really validated in some way. And like, I'm not saying this is a K-drama thing, I'm just saying I noticed this in a K-drama, and
yeah,
that was the first time that I appreciated a character that was kind of static and annoying, but like really comforting in some way. Because I'm like, you know, sometimes I am that person. Sometimes I don't experience the change that I want to change, that I want to experience, even though I have so many, you know, people pushing me to change.
Yeah, I think the criticism that you speak to is a lesson that we've also heard called the hero's journey. So I can share a little bit more about what the hero's journey is. It's a common narrative archetype or story template that involves a hero who goes on an adventure, learns a lesson, wins a victory with that newfound knowledge, and then returns home transformed. So a lot of times this hero will return to like their normal life, which is where they began. And it is either that setting has fully changed, whether it's like they brought home some technological advancement, so now life for everyone is so much easier, or the setting is the same and the person themselves has changed so much that they are like almost unrecognizable to like the people around them. And I think what I totally agree that Namdo-san is a very relatable and static character. And I think what this kind of made me think of was how when we consume so many stories that involve a character transforming, you know, in the span of an hour and a half movie or in the span of 16-hour episodes, and I just feel like, what does that teach us about what growth means? Like, I wonder if in some ways by watching all of these characters go through so much change and learn so much, I wonder how much subconscious pressure I put on myself to like grow and change all the time and to be learning, when maybe in fact I could just be happy the way I am at the moment and not strive to improve myself in any way or to learn something new, because life is always going to happen. So I'm always naturally going to be learning and changing in some ways without actively pursuing it.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think the relatability that K-dramas or even longer TV shows like This Is Us, I think they offer that feeling of relatability because you can see yourself moving at the same pace as the characters. Whereas in an hour-long movie, like the, if it was just like a mimicking of my life in an hour, that would be no fun, right? So that's a good point.
Yeah. So I'm curious what passages in Craft in the Real World really stuck out to you that maybe they were like, oh, I really had never thought about this before reading this book.
Yeah, there was one part about the section where he introduces some things that are might be useful in the more traditional Chinese fiction structure of putting together a story. And it talks about how we just talked about how a three-act structure is very popular. But in some other cultures, a four-act structure can be really popular, where it's like, instead of beginning, middle, and end, the four-act structure has introduction, development, twist, and reconciliation. And conflict is not necessary. And I thought that was really interesting because conflict, when I read this, I was like, I can't even imagine conflict not being part of a story. But then again, when I think about some of those like slice of life, vibey pieces, I'm like, oh, you know, something can be really interesting even without like an explicit fight or conflict.
Yeah, that is like the centerpiece for the whole movie or for the whole show. I totally agree because, again, thinking about how I'm impacted by these stories, do I kind of see all my conflicts as very gargantuan because I'm so used to seeing movies that focus on
one whole conflict for like an hour and a half, maybe. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, times when like I bicker with someone and like, you know, it could, I think in K-dramas, that's kind of celebrated. Like, it's kind of like the fun part of life to kind of just poke jabs at your family members or your friends and to be kind of getting along in that way. But I can imagine that in other scenarios, but depending on the angle of it, those can be seen as conflicts, as things that I need to address in order to make my life easier and make my life better.
Totally. That's a really good point about like when we see conflicts, you know, play out in an hour. Does that give us the pressure of needing to resolve conflicts in our life within an hour? And also, does it lead us to ever dramatize our life where it's like, I'm narrating my life and wow, I'm a movie character and this is so dramatic and awful and I need to go fight with this person and resolve this person. Like, I don't know, it's kind of a tiring way to live. And I also think about like vlogs, which are not a traditional like fiction piece, but even something like a vlog, it can be really entertaining and beautiful and fun to watch, even if there's no one like fighting someone else. It could just be like, I'm going on a journey from A to B and I encounter some beautiful things along the way and boom, that's it. That's the story. Done.
Yeah. No, I totally agree because one vlogger I really like is Michelle Choi. And a lot of times in her vlog, she does the same things over and over again. She just cleans her house and cooks food. There's nothing particularly special about any of the things that she's doing, but I keep watching each one over and over again. Like every time she puts out a new video, I watch it, even though I know like it's probably going to be the same thing. I'm always curious. I think the questions that I end up having are like, what is she cooking for this video? Like what new cleaning gadget did she get that's going to make her life easier in some ways? She doesn't even necessarily have like the highlight really moments where, you know, she's like showing just wanderlust, like only times when she's like surrounded by a ton of people. She shows like, she does show that, but it's not always like the focus of each vlog and the storytelling that she chooses to do, which I personally find really, really refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What parts of the book did you like? I know you ended up making some TikTok videos.
A lesson in traditional Chinese fiction, which is that Chinese fiction is not afraid of intense emotion. So rather than showing the emotion, for example, pouring water into a cup until it overflows to show sadness, or an angel statue with its wings cut off to show the feeling of being trapped, melodrama is actually preferable in this medium. So writing that's meant to evoke a reaction from the audience rather than just represent an individual character is considered good craft in traditional Chinese fiction. So if we go back to telenovelas and K-dramas, sudden cancer diagnosis, that's really startling. And that's like, oh my God, what is this world coming to?
Right.
And there, some people, that might not be their cup of tea because they may feel like, oh, that's like so overdone. That is just came out of nowhere. It's not really showing me anything about this person's character or like what this it doesn't represent anything about this character. But I personally feel like, again, there's things in life that are really unpredictable and you can't really plan for a sudden cancer diagnosis or finding out that you have a long lost twin that you just didn't know about. And I think because for me personally, I haven't had those things happen in my life. In some ways, it's kind of exciting and engaging to see those left field scenes happen and to be like, oh, like shit, like I don't know how I would react in this situation. How are these people going to react and move the story along?
Someone commented on that TikTok video and talked about how different people have different levels of ability to interpret something so abstract like pouring water into a glass. And so when it's so subtle and inexplicit, people can leave being confused and having very different levels of understanding of your story. Whereas if it's more explicit than everyone, especially if you're watching a movie as a group, everyone can like be more on the same page about what just happened.
Yeah, I think that kind of goes back to like accessibility even in storytelling. So the first thought that just came to mind is Inside Out. There is a scene in Inside Out where Riley is, when she's very young, she's given broccoli and she's like, ew, this is disgusting. And that creates the emotion disgust in her head. Pixar chose to change that scene in every single culture where broccoli is not considered the culturally like disgusting food. So for example, in Japan, they completely reanimated it so that it was spinach, because spinach was the thing that people in Japan don't usually like when they're very, very young. And the same thing with sports. Riley in the US version plays ice hockey. In other countries like Europe, where ice hockey is not really a thing, they had her play soccer or football, it would be called. Yeah. And so I thought that was so above and beyond for that studio to do, to recognize that the feelings around ice hockey or broccoli like might not even translate, even though you see the visual food in front of them. And so to make sure that everyone else is kind of like on the same page, they chose to make those visual changes as well. And I know that with live action, that maybe isn't as much flexibility in order to do those things. But yeah, like even I've heard that in other cultures, like nodding your head actually means saying no. And that's also different and opposite of what we do. And so there's so many cultural nuances that you just may not realize are not translating. And I think people can, you know, pick apart and hyper-analyze so many movies. And I think that's why it can be so exclusive, because there's like this select group of people who have done filmmaking for decades at this point, and they all consume the same exact type of media. And so
they get the references.
They get the references, whereas maybe other people might not know the references, but because it's kind of been established as this is the holy grail classics of film or TV or books, it's kind of just assumed that like, oh, we should all be, you know, learning from this and doing things in a similar way because they have a proven track record. So
when you're in film school, do you find that your peers think it's like more artsy and like alluring to create films that are really subtle and hard to understand? Like, is that like a flex? Is that a cool thing?
Okay, this is also a hot take. I don't know if people may come after me in the in the comments for this, but there's a Korean movie called Burning that I had heard about, and it played at Cannes Film Festival. It was like a big deal back in 2018, and Steven Yeun is in this movie too. And so I was really intrigued and was always curious about watching it, and I watched it with James. And the whole time, I kept asking James, like, do you know what's going on? I literally don't understand what's going on. And he'd be like, I know what's going on. Nothing. Nothing is happening in this movie. And I was like, yeah, like, why did people rave about this? Like, I really had a hard time understanding. And fast forward in film school, we're talking about cinematography, and this movie is brought up, and immediately influx of comments of people being like, this is my favorite movie ever. This is incredible. And I was like, oh, whoa. I like kind of have a hot take. And now I honestly like don't know if I want to share with people that I actually don't understand this movie. Because I'm kind of like, what am I not getting for me to not like this film the same way that other people like the films?
Interesting.
Yeah. And I think something that Juliana said when we did our episode with her, she talked about how she also really wants poetry to be accessible, and how she really believes that poetry shouldn't be something that people have to agonize over to like peel apart the meaning and the writer's intention behind it. It should be okay for people to just take away what they choose to take away from it, even if it's not as deep as maybe the writer intended it to be. And so I really appreciated that perspective, and it kind of gave me hope that people do care about the accessibility of these stories being told. And sometimes things are okay to be very, very explicit, I think.
Totally.
Another thing that we can learn from traditional Chinese fiction is the difference between dramatic irony and romantic irony. So he says, in Western fiction, we have dramatic irony, which is when the audience knows something that the characters do not. So a classic example would be, we find out that the daughter in the family, she has a secret boyfriend. And from the beginning, we know this, and we know that she hasn't told her parents. The whole movie, we are waiting for that moment that the parent finds out that she has a secret boyfriend, right? So that is like an example of the in that an audience has that some characters don't actually know about yet. So the opposite of dramatic irony that exists in traditional Chinese fiction is romantic irony, which is when the author creates the effect that there is no separation between audience and characters, real world from fictional world. This can be achieved via intrusions by an author character and a reader character. and via framing devices and stories within stories, and a constant questioning of what is real and authentic, both in fiction and in real life.
Wait, what does a reader character even look like? Like, do you have an example of that?
Well, I think the reader character is pretty much the audience. Like, we are, the author has chosen to kind of make us the character in terms of, like, are in the unknown just as much as all the characters. So a really good example of this actually is Attack on Titan. So Attack on Titan is all about the end of humanity is coming because they're enclosed in walls, kind of like Ba Sing Se in Avatar. And they're enclosed because it's keeping them safe from these humanoid giant zombie called Titans. The first episode kind of begins with like the wall being broken. And so these Titans come in and they eat people. And literally this is the last of humanity. But the protagonist has always admired this one, a military troop called the Scouts. And the reason he admires them so much is because they take that risk to like learn more outside the walls. They go outside the walls to venture into the unknown so that they can learn more about Titans and learn more about what else is out there in the world because that history is lost. So this is such a good show because all of us, like all of the viewers, don't know what's happening. And so we're all kind of like conspiring together in forums or on social media to better understand, like, is there any indicator of like what could be out there? And for the most part, every single reveal came out of nowhere. And we're like, whoa, that's insane. But we get to kind of be along in the ride the same way that these characters are, which is really cool.
Oh, okay. Another example I can think of is some mystery or like detective stories where the narrator is like kind of speaks to the audience and is like, oh, what do you think is happening? Like, why do you think they did this? And then you sort of question the reliability of the narrator. And then you start to question your own memory of what the narrator said. I feel like that's the vibe I'm getting.
Yeah, another movie that it makes me think of is, have you ever seen Memento by Christopher Nolan?
Yes.
Yeah, like it makes me think of that because of how jarring the transitions are between the two different timelines and one timeline going backwards and one timeline going forwards. Mm-hmm. I feel like that kind of kept me guessing the whole time of like, oh shoot, like this guy's been tattooing, you know, pieces of his memory so that he doesn't forget. But clearly something's wrong because apparently he hasn't seen this person before, and but he thought he did.
Chills.
Right? Like that movie, I think that movie was insane, and like it made my brain work overtime because I was trying to keep up with what was going on. Because even the character who has short-term memory loss also doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good tidbit, huh?
Yeah. So another interesting thing about this book is that the author takes the liberty to redefine a lot of common terms that we know of right now. And so I wanted to kind of go through a couple of them. So the first one is plot. So plot, how would you define plot?
Plot is like this series of, it's like the series of events that push the story forward. Like, oh, I'm going towards my goal, or I'm being pushed away from my goal. Oh, I'm going towards my goal again.
Yeah. So he actually chooses to redefine it as the acceptance or rejection of consequences. This is like a little explanation that he has for why he defined it this way. So given the context of the traditional story structure that we were learning as we were growing up, fictional protagonists often have vast, incomprehensible power enough to save worlds because the worlds are theirs. The plots of these books support the idea that human agency is how to make sense of the human experience. They also support certain ideas about who should have that agency and who should not. It's no coincidence that most of these books were about well-off white kids. Whom were they written for then? Believing that agency is heroic, I personally felt that my life was villainous. I wanted to change the world rather than to accept or reject the consequences of living in it. Consequence in my life originated in systems of power, whether that meant my family, the adoption industry, the school system, or so on. If we think of plot as acceptance or rejection of consequences, we are able to take into account constant negotiations with power. Acceptance and rejection are often emotional, not active. Sometimes a character's negotiations with power are a part of a string of causation and sometimes not. And so to put plot in terms of acceptance and rejection is also to put plot in sociocultural context. Acceptance and rejection are cultural. And then the last part he says is that the hero story, so alluding to the hero's journey we talked about, is its own fantasy for a lot of people. Like, I think it makes me think of like a lot of POC folks living in America. Mm-hmm. The hero story is its own fantasy. Coincidence, routine, unexplainable emotion, even the weather can be profound. The king dies and then the queen dies, but the people still have laundry to do, children to feed, love to love, lives that continue in all directions, not each independent of the other, but more meaningful for how they intersect. If I were to rephrase it into a way that I understand it, using the word progression that you use, it is the constant progression of acceptance or rejection of these consequences. So, for example, if, you know, a natural disaster were to be like the incident that happens for someone, they have to choose whether they're going to accept the consequences of that or if they're going to reject the consequences of that.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so I think traditional definitions of plot are like, what did I do at each step? Whereas this is a little bit more nuanced, where it's like, before you do anything, you have to decide whether you accept the situation or you reject it and you want to do something. And so it actually expands the definition of plot to include the times when you decide to reject the status quo and do something. And also, plot is also including the times when you just choose to let things
be the way that they were.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a more, maybe if we want to talk about it from the lens of race, let's take the movie The Hate U Give, for example. It starts off with a Black girl with another friend who is Black, and he drives the car and he gets pulled over by the police. She warns her friend to put his hands onto the dashboard, which he refuses to do because he thinks it's ridiculous. And now he ends up getting shot by a white police officer. Mm-hmm. And so that's like the big incident that happened in that movie. I think with this redefinition of plot being acceptance or rejection of consequences, I think it also takes into account the fact that the whole justice system is working against Black people. And so this protagonist, in the ideal world, she could be that hero who, you know, like overturns the whole system, is able to make insurmountable change that affects the whole world and changes policies and all that stuff. But sometimes the reality is maybe her situation could have been that she is too young. Like, she literally like does not have any power in the situation to make any changes. And she also can't bring her friend back to life. And so what is she going to do with this knowledge and with this context? Because even if she were to argue against the system is already working against her. And so there should and doesn't need to be an expectation on them to have argued against this or to have done anything more than they already are doing with the time that they have and the resources. The second one is conflict, which, again, we talked about how conflict is in every film, every story, every book we read. He redefines it as conflict is what gives or takes away the illusion of free will. So again, he says that the biggest issue when it comes to conflict is that conflict is taught as if it should come out of the protagonist and be solved by them, aka caused by self and can be solved by the development of the self. But he questions how much of the conflict you face is actually caused by your own actions. How much of it is really on you? It needs context on race, class, gender, ability, etc. The question of how much of the conflict you face is a matter of fate or free will can also have meaningful consequences. Think about things that happen in the workplace. We may see someone maybe of a similar identity as us going through so much. We inevitably feel like we should take up responsibility to help them out, even though whatever situation that they're in doesn't necessarily mean that's something that's caused by me. Like, who is the one that should be taking up responsibility? It should be the system. But the system is not really a compelling character for a lot of people to be watching. Mm.
Yeah, that is really interesting. It kind of reminds me of this concept in psych where, do you go through life with an inner locus of control or outer locus of control? Where it's like, if something bad happens to you, do you expect that there's something within me that I can do to change the situation? Or are you more like, there's not much I can do, everything's out of my control? And I think traditionally there's been a lot of research on like, oh, people who have an inner locus of control, they're happier because they see more agency in the world and they maybe have more of like a quote unquote growth mindset where they can control all the factors that impact their experience of life. But I think what you just said makes me think that inner locus of control is kind of your experience of it and your ability to like actually control the world really depends on your position in the world, right? Like, mm-hmm. like what is your identity? What are the identities that are like elevated in, you know, the society that you live in? And it might be mm-hmm. actually kind of disempowering to read a story of a character who's able to make so much change and do so much, but then to look in your own life and be like, I actually do not have that level of control over my circumstances. Like, not even close, not mm-hmm. at all.
Mm-hmm, definitely. The third term is story arc, which is actually, in my head, I kind of felt like this was kind of similar to plot. But if you think about story arc, it has like a natural dip, ebb, and flow and upward motion too throughout the story. Mm-hmm. So story arc, he says, is how the world in which the character lives is changed or fails to be changed. So again, setting that expectation that there are aspects of someone's world that don't always have to change because of the character. Mm-hmm. Some things are not going to change no matter how much effort you put in. Yeah. And some things also don't need to be changed as well.
Right. And that's cool. Like starting the writing process by deciding, hey, these things are going to change, but other things are not. Like I don't have to put energy into making everything an uphill arc.
Yeah, for sure. You probably have heard in recent news that when it comes to POC movies that people who are usually white will complain that characters are not believable or mm-hmm. relatable. Mm-hmm. So I like Matthew's take on this term. He defines believability as the differences and similarities between various characters' expectations. And I think you can also then look at relatability, which he defines as how the characters are presented to the implied reader. And I think the implied reader is so important because it again goes back to the question, who is this story for? I feel like we don't spend a lot of time talking about how there are some stories that are great for people to read or to consume and others that people are just not going to get. And because you don't get it, that doesn't mean it's a bad book or it doesn't mean it's a bad story. It just means it was not written for you. Yes, exactly. There was a TikTok that I shared with you where mm-hmm. she talks about how she sometimes gets frustrated because she'll be reading, you know, POC authors books and like obviously wants to support them. But she feels like she can kind of like categorize them into two things. Either it's a book that's written for a white audience in mind or a book written for their community's audience in mind. And you can notice it with something like food. So for example, as a Korean, if I'm reading a Korean person's book, a book that is written for the white audience in mind, it might involve a lot of explanation about what kind of food we're eating, what goes into the food, like kimchi jjigae. I may write kimchi jjigae and then or a fermented spicy cabbage stew that has been stewing for hours. Versus if it was just with a community's audience in mind, it might just list a bunch of, you know, italicized words that are all in Korean and we just move on from it. Because it's not so important to that story at the moment. And we have other things to get to in this story because we've normalized that people already know what these foods are. But with a white audience, they need a little bit more hand-holding and, you know, understanding and context setting as much as, you know, anyone would if they're like a tourist in another country. Mm-hmm. And so that was really interesting to listen to because, again, we want to celebrate all of these stories, like maybe we can also start to kind of see like, oh, like where did this author maybe intend or where did they maybe find challenging to like decide whether this was going to hit with a white audience because, you know, business reasons or if it was meant to be just purely for their community and they took that risk. And it's considered a risk still. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so cool. Yeah. Do you see this changing your approach to script writing at all for your films? Because writing a fiction book is different from writing a script.
I think so. So at the end of this book, he actually puts a lot of really interesting exercises. So
he does.
For example, yeah. So for example, let's see. He writes this whole exercise about the audience, which maybe like isn't something that I personally have not had that experience of defining an audience for the mm-hmm. stories that I write. Mm-hmm. And so he has this exercise where it starts off by naming one person or few people who first see your work and who would get every reference. And then describe an audience about 1,000 people who would be ideal readers for your book and whom you hope to reach. So for example, he might say he wants this book to have the audience of college graduate male Korean American adoptees, politically active between 30 and 40 in a heterosexual relationship with kids who read more than 20 books a year, aka him. And so I thought it was really cool that he was able to so specifically define that. And then he moves on to then describe an audience about 20,000 who would make your book a bestseller. So it becomes a little bit broader. And then he says, okay, now let's write. But he says, let's write a paragraph about your protagonist's identity that accommodates an outside audience. So kind of going back to that TikTok. And then rewrite that paragraph to address your specific readers. And how is that different? And I think that's a really cool exercise because you can kind of see how your writing style changes. And there's no wrong answer in terms of who the audience is. It's whoever you intentionally choose it to be. And then you can let your writing kind of speak for itself as a result.
Yeah, that's so cool. That's actually... I mean, this is so, it's an abstract connection, but that's something that we do when you're practicing like piano or your voice, where it's like, if you want to practice a certain technique, what you should do is practice the exact opposite to help train your mind to identify what the gap is that you want to practice and work towards instead of, and what you want to work away from. And that's what I see the author suggesting here too, where it's like, it's helpful to define like the direction that you want to go to and also define the direction that you're wanting to like move away from, because that helps you like more clearly move towards a specific direction.
Another fun one that he, another fun exercise has to do with like developing your voice in writing. Like you hear people talk about that, that they have like a really cool writing style or a really interesting voice. And he says, you should list your fears both past and present. Not something triggering, something irrational. For example, I have a fear of dolls. And then you write a fictional scene in which one of those fears plays out and write in the voice of the person experiencing fear. How does what happens affect and change how your character sees the world? The third way to go about doing it is to write the same scene from the voice from some of someone causing the fear. So you again get to see like the two different perspectives. And I think oftentimes we just think about the protagonist. And so this is a really cool way to kind of think about, one, creating interesting characters that maybe aren't always so relatable to you, but maybe can be relatable to some other people. And two, it also allows for you to create more complex characters because you really like wrote, like you really just rounded out their descriptions and the way that they speak and their perspective on the world around this fear that you have. And fear is just such a, such an interesting emotion to play with in stories. So I feel like I'm gonna need to buy the physical copy of this book and just annotate it like crazy, taking some of your tips from reading nonfiction. And I am really excited to just see how my characters really develop and how my writing style changes based on a lot of these exercises and these reframings of terms.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you're going to do differently or try to look out for next time you watch something or read a book?
Yeah. My big takeaway here is that I can just enjoy the visuals or the music or the vibes of a movie or story or a book without always having to have a takeaway, right? It's not always about, oh, what did the character learn that I can learn from my life? Sometimes it's just about like experiencing a moment and stepping into a world, and like you don't have to come out of it with like a life-changing realization. You can just enjoy it.
Yeah, maybe that's a, maybe that would be like a really good exercise for us in a future podcast episode where we maybe watch or read something that maybe didn't really have like a standout takeaway, but how just do vibes. We talk about, how do we talk about this book? Like, what would that podcast episode about this story be? I'm just kind of curious, like, what that would even look like. Because I feel like we always kind of talk about, oh, what else could we say to add to the conversation? But maybe it's just not adding to the conversation. Maybe it's just sharing it. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. So we talked about a lot of sections of this book, but for people who maybe you actually want to read the rest of it, what are some other pieces of content that in the book they can look forward to?
Yeah, so other pieces in the book you can look forward to. There's this whole thing about terminology at the beginning, which I thought was really fascinating that people can really look into. There's more lessons about traditional Chinese fiction that you probably will notice when you watch Asian-inspired or Asian-centric content. And so that would be really more things that you can look forward to. And there's tons of other terms that he defines. Like he defines tone. What else does he define? He defines characterization. He defines vulnerability. And so there are, and these are all like full-on chapters for each term. So we only scratched the surface with this book. Yeah.
Wait, I like how this is like a tool book for both professional storytellers and also like someone who just, you know, someone like me.
I think just someone who loves stories. Yeah. Anyone who loves stories, I think it would be just so interesting to revisit and rewatch some of the things that you've maybe loved or maybe haven't loved in the past and see how your perspective changes with these new definitions.
Yeah. This has been such a fun conversation, and I wanted to keep it going by recommending some other episodes that we've done. So in episode 120, we talk about our friend Juliana Chang's chapbook. It's a beautiful collection of poems, and it's titled Inheritance. And we talk about her experiences traversing continents, careers, languages, and generations. And so she was the friend who, she's a friend of ours who is a poet and gave us some insight, shared some of her experiences about and desire for poetry to be more accessible. And another episode we did was 181, How to Enjoy Reading Fiction and Nonfiction. So spoiler alert, Tan is much more enjoys fiction, and I much more enjoy nonfiction, and we swap some tips and ideas for how to enjoy the other person's preferred genre.
Yes. It's funny because we ended up referencing both of these episodes throughout our conversation. And so if you enjoyed this conversation and would like to hear from our reader perspectives in the how to read nonfiction and fiction, as well as a creator herself, Juliana, definitely check out those episodes. And with that, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you are at all interested in this book, we'll link it in the description below. And if you find it interesting, please share it with a friend who may also find it interesting, a fellow lover of stories or a creative themselves. And with that, let us know if you would like us to talk more about this book or what other questions you have around storytelling, and we'll be sure to do a future episode on it. And with that, we hope you all have a great rest of your week, and we'll see you next Sunday. Bye!